Access number 12502, Reel 15.
Field Marshal Lord Bramall, Reel 15. You were saying that it was necessary to contemplate some sort of threat of pressure, if not invasion, by the PM.
Yes, I mean, I think one was thinking more in terms of confrontational measures, like turning the water off, or putting an embargo on, trying to influence events inside Hong Kong, disturbances, riots, and so on, that side of it. But I have to say that in the period that we were there, there was beginning to be a change of heart. You see, when I went out there, Douglas Hurd had just written a book called The Smile on the Face of the Tiger, because he was an author, you know. And this was presupposing a confrontation situation, riots in which the governor wasn't attacked, certainly the ADC to the commander of British forces was killed. The Chinese were massing on the Hong Kong border. We sent a Polaris submarine out to make the point. And eventually, the inference was that by the influence of Chou En-lai, the Chinese backed down. Well, that was the scenario which commander of British forces had ringing in his ears. But during the time I was there, the Cultural Revolution was over. Deng Xiaoping was coming back into power. Both Mao and Zhou Enlai died.
That was September in 76, yeah, wasn't it? When Mao died.
Yes. They died in the wrong...
In the wrong order.
If Mao died first and Zhou Enlai second, half the problems wouldn't have occurred. But Zhou Enlai died first, and then Mao Zedong. And there was a gradually getting back to a more stable relationship, and we actually began to have quite friendly relationship with the Chinese representatives in Hong Kong. It would have been still too early for the commander of British forces to visit China. I visited China since, but it would have been too early for that to have happened. That would have been felt that somehow we were selling the pass. But the things were getting on a more normal basis, and it was not thought that the threat from China was imminent. Of course, what was going to happen in 1997, everybody was still asking that question, and of course that was not resolved until the treaty was signed a few years back.
How much did you know about the PLA in general and immediately?
Oh, we knew a lot about the PLA. There were a great many what were euphemistically or generally called China watchers in Hong Kong. And so we knew a good deal about what was happening over the other side of the border. And there was nothing, I mean, in a true war sense, there wasn't much to be alarmed about because, of course, they were very old-fashioned, the Chinese military forces, but, of course, there were so many of them. And they were pretty hard-nosed along the border. I mean, we saw them the other side, but there was no fraternization across the Hong Kong border at all. And, of course, in some places, the Hong Kong border ran through the middle of a town. 200 yards away, there was the Chinese sentry. So we kept alert on our guard. We kept our forces trained for war rather than for a particular war. Trained in operating over the hills and the mountains and doing all the things the soldiers should be trained in rather than for a specific campaign. And also, of course, trained in internal security.
I was going to say that it would probably be more within the style of Chinese policy to disrupt Hong Kong from within rather than to invade it from without, to engineer chaos and then an invitation to the PLA to restore order. Was there ever any hint of that occurring?
Well, that is, I mean, that would have been the scenario that we would have thought most likely. But there was no direct indication that that was happening.
The other thing that the Chinese have done from time to time, as far as I remember, is to send in waves of political refugees to embarrass the colony. Did that happen at all while you were there?
Yes, this was our... this was really our big task. I had two waves of refugees when I was there, both of which, to some extent, I was responsible for having to compete with. First of all, the day that the Queen made her very first visit to Hong Kong, and all the governor was up to his neck in the visit, first time it had happened, the first ship of Vietnamese refugees arrived off Hong Kong. And the governor said to me, I've got too much on my plate. The military must handle the whole thing. And we had to meet the ship, take the people off, put them into camps, and this was the start of the Vietnamese refugee problem. So that was one. And the second was, and I don't know, I noticed your words, sent in to embarrass Hong Kong.
Well, allowed to cross the border.
Yes, well... yes, I suppose they must have had a hand in this, although they always said they didn't, and they always wanted the people back, and they wanted to send them to some sort of corrective centre to show them the error of their ways. But we started to get a large number of refugees coming in from China. Now, you could make a case that these were genuine fleers from repression, but that, generally speaking, wasn't the case. They were people who were attracted by the bright lights of flesh pots and the economic advantages of Hong Kong and wanted to come and make their pile. And some of them, of course, were people on the run from, rightly or wrongly, from Chinese law. And they came all sorts of ways. They came across the land border, they came by sea, they came by boat, they came by swimming, and we had to stop them because it was agreed that they would have absolutely swamped the economy. And it was also agreed on the assurance of the Chinese that they would not be repressively dealt with when they went back, and this was kept to, because many of them came back two or three times. They were handed back to the Chinese, and of course the military had to provide the framework for the whole of this operation. So these were the actual operations that we really had to carry out. And the border one, of course, again, was very good training, because we, you know, these people came mostly across at night. We had to have patrols on the border, we had to have night vision, we had to have, we hardly had any resistance. I think we had one Gurkha knifed in the course of the thing, but generally speaking, they gave up quietly, and they were taken along, and they were handed back to the Chinese authorities at a certain place. So that was one of the things we had to do. The decision was taken in the Executive Council to do this. It was a decision that had to be thought about very carefully, because people could say that we were denying people the right, genuine right of asylum. But we were satisfied that these were not people. These were people who just wanted to earn a quick buck.
There was a theory at one time that Hong Kong, the colony, was being used as a dumping ground for bad hats by the local Chinese governors, that they were only too happy to send their criminal types into Hong Kong.
Well, I think they couldn't have minded. I mean, I don't think... I mean, that was a sort of... yes, it was easy. It was easy for them to let them go. I mean, I think if they'd put more military effort, they could have stopped. They did stop quite a few people, but they obviously they let some go for one reason or another. But they got them all back again. So, eventually we got cooperation on both sides of the border to this. and as relations improved, so that got better still.
Did this mean that you had to have direct contact with officers of the
Yes, we did. We didn't do it. We did it through the political advisor and the police, but they had direct contact, although we provided the bulk of the troops to do it.
Now, the other thing that comes to mind with regard to internal security in Hong Kong is not so much political subversion, but organised criminal activity.
Yeah, that's perfectly true, because, of course, has nothing to do with my period there, but look, I'm told that one of the most unpleasant manifestations over recent years, or certainly over recent months, is that the triads, which have always been the basis of crime in Hong Kong, rather like the mafia in parts of America, the triads are now linked in with the criminal elements in southern China. And this is producing gun running and drugs and all these other things. And, of course, it is the criminal element. And that is why the Hong Kong police have got a very, very big job on their hands. And, of course, between now and 1997, this is going to be probably an increasing problem.
Was there any large-scale smuggling of commodities in or out of the colony from mainland China when you were there?
Well, there'd be nothing... I'm just trying to think what you mean about this. Of course, most of the stuff would be... In those days, there would be no point in smuggling things in from China to Hong Kong, because Hong Kong had everything and China had nothing. And if you were taking it the other way, there weren't too many two people in China who could afford to buy these things. So I don't think smuggling in that sense, unless, of course, you got drug running, which came up from the Golden Triangle in Thailand, whether you got drugs coming in that way. But, of course, it was a fairly short border. The seaways, the two bays either side, were very much patrolled by the Marine Police and by the Royal Navy. So you obviously were on a lookout for these things. I mean, there was obviously a certain amount of smuggling, but I wouldn't have said it was one of the main problems. The main problems were people coming in wanting to make money.
Did you ever go to visit Macau?
Yes. Macau, of course, was a mini, very mini Hong Kong, still, of course, run by the Portuguese. And I assume that China will take that over in 1997 as far as sovereignty is concerned, just as it will Hong Kong. But Macau was a gambling place, great gambling place. There was no gambling allowed in Hong Kong, except Mahjong, where officially money shouldn't pass, and of course racing, which was very legalized and provided a source of revenue for all the welfare improvements in the colony. And there was no doubt that during my time there, thanks to the governor, Hong Kong was developing a much greater social conscience. When I started there, the numbers of shanty town settlements all over the hillsides was enormous. By the end, it had been greatly reduced, and people were living in respectable flats and housing estates. And now there are hardly any shanty towns at all. So there's been a terrific social confidence to do people to benefit the lot of the ordinary person in Hong Kong, which is why, of course, they don't want to see themselves being flooded out by refugees from Vietnam or from China.
What was the policy on the Vietnamese refugees at that time? Because this was very early stages, wasn't it?
Well, of course, there were very much fewer of them than there are now, but we opened a great many camps. We tried to see that they didn't escape into the society. We obviously tried to treat them in a humane, feed them, clothe them humane fashion. But, of course, some of the camps were quite congested. And then we tried to persuade people to take these refugees to Australia, America, places like that. And, of course, quite a number of them were taken. Some came to this country, not very many. And the problem is still with the colony, very much so. Not enough people have been taken by the other countries, and now they're having to be sent back to Vietnam.
Were those early refugees genuinely political, do you think, or were they a mixture of economic and political refugees?
No, I mean, you remember, this was in the first flush. When I was there in 73, end of 73, you remember it was the awful scenes of the Americans finally pulling out of Vietnam. And these were all people who weren't prepared to stand around and wait for the North Vietnamese to take over the whole country. In that sense, they were political. I mean, I don't think people nowadays, they are, people are like the Chinese refugees, I think, who say, you know, we just don't like living here and we can't make enough money and the sound of Hong Kong is much more glamorous and we want to get out into a different sort of society. But I think those, then it was people who were just in terror of what was going to happen. And they went all over Southeast Asia, and some of them, of course, didn't make the journey. And some of them got turned back. But these people, at that time, could not be turned back. I mean, they were, otherwise they'd have gone straight back into a regime against whom the Americans had been fighting up until that time.
Now, when you were sitting on the Executive Council, how was business conducted?
Well, this was fascinating. I was, as I say, I was number two in the colony, although when the governor went away, the chief secretary, who was, I think, three or four, the chief justice might have been the other one, he came above me to be the acting governor, but up to that time I was number two. And I sat with the leading citizens, partly European and partly Chinese, who sat on the Executive Council, I suppose about 12 people or something like that. And they were people nominated by the governor. Many of them had been legislative councillors beforehand. And there was a senior one, senior Chinese member of the Executive Council, was a very important chap. In my day, it was a man called Sir Y.K. Khan, and then Sir S.Y. Chung, who's very much around still today. And we met at least once, sometimes twice a week, and discussed the affairs of state like a cabinet.
Did you find that that experience was valuable training for your return to Whitehall?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, it was invaluable because you had two-way traffic. And that was why I was terribly anxious to make sure that when I was a chief of staff, the chief of staff was always represented, was always present, not in the full cabinet in this country, but in the defence committee of the cabinet. But you had to make the point, otherwise the civil service would be all for sort of easing you out. But of course it has a marvellous two-way affair, because not only do you make sure that the politicians and the civil servants are aware of the security situation, but because you are in tune with the political situation, you lead the military in a realistic direction, an achievable direction, and not ask for things which are quite impossible or out of touch with what is going on in the real world. It's a wonderful two-way traffic. And the Commander of British Forces, although he's now only a Major General, he still sits on Exco, and is still going to continue to sit on Exco, I hope, right up until 1997.
Did the Chief of Police also have a place
No.
on the committee?
He didn't. No, security was the CBF's responsibility. There was a Governor's Security Committee, which the Chief of Police did sit on, the Commissioner of Police, with the CBF. But on the Executive Council, he did not.
The Hong Kong police force has a sort of semi-military aspect, doesn't it?
Well, it has a, like so many of these Far East police forces, it has a paramilitary element, that is to say, it has a field force companies who can deploy for riots and small military actions and so on, as well as the ordinary side of the police, the uniformed police, the CID, the special branch. They have this field force as well, police field force it's called.
Did you find them inefficient?
No, I thought the Hong Kong police on the whole were very efficient. I mean, there was an endemic area of corruption in the police, but I mean, I don't know many Far East forces where that does not exist. But on the whole, it was an efficient police force, there's no doubt about it. Much depended, of course, on who the commissioner was at the time, but on the whole, it was a good police force, and our plans for internal security and our machinery for internal security and the joint operations rooms that we had all around the on the island and the new territories, that was a very coherent arrangement.
Was there any threat of corruption of the military forces there?
Well, a very good question, because when they set up the Independent Commission of Corruption, everyone was encouraged to write in and say, you know, so-and-so is fiddling the books. And, of course, a lot of people had axes to grind and old debts to pay off and so on like that. But it was quite incredible. I mean, compared with all other aspects of... Well, it was incredible, but it was very encouraging. Compared with all aspects of Hong Kong life, and the police, of course, had endless complaints made about them. The number of actual complaints made against the armed forces by anybody was minute, about a dozen or something like that. And of that, there wouldn't have been more than one of two of which were sustained at all.
Could that perhaps be because of the rotation of units in?
Well, I think that must be something to do with it, but I do like to think that the British Armed Forces do have a code of conduct which only the odd bad apple in the barrel prepared to break. And it was very encouraging. It was certainly proved by events. Well, of course, the number of complaints against the police were a vast number. Not all of them were proven, but there were a tremendous lot of accusations. And in other aspects of public life as well. So it wasn't a big problem. Nor was drugs a big problem in the armed forces in those days at all. No, we had a pretty clean bit of health. But it was nothing that you can get complacent about. I think you had to remind people time to time.
Well, given that bribery and corruption are absolutely endemic in that sort of society.
Yes.
You could argue they're not.
It was all done in a very, very subtle way, you know.
Well done. The fact that it was done subtly would make it even more dangerous.
That's right, too. That's right.
You wouldn't realise it was happening until it was too late.
Since then, I mean, before I was there, this is a generalisation, but before I was there, is this still on or not?
Yeah.
Most of the CBFs were coming to the end of their time. But since then, all the CBFs, nearly all, have gone on up. And I think it is looked upon as a very useful training ground. I mean, the last CGS, Chapel, of course, was commanded there. The one who's still commanding now is going up to Lieutenant General. General Borman went up to Lieutenant General. Everybody went. General Archer went to full general. So they've nearly all gone on up, because it was considered to be a very good training ground, I think. In them.
Well, obviously, it's going to become more and more sensitive and tricky as the
date,
and 1997 approaches.
That's right.
Then I think you came back to be GOC of United Kingdom Land Forces. Mm.
Well, that was really a rather strange job. You were called the Commander-in-Chief, but you didn't really command anything, really. You, of course, had the responsibility, which has now been delegated to your deputy commander-in-chief for the training of the Home Army, and you had to visit all the army at home. You had a lot of districts under you who, of course, were really did most of their administration direct with the Ministry of Defence. And it was called management by exception. So I likened it mostly to being an appointment which existed before the war, and Tiny Ironside had it, called Inspector General. I reckon that I was the Inspector General of the Home Forces, really, more than Commander-in-Chief. And I had really no influence because I had no direct influence because, for instance, the troops that I sent off to Northern Ireland were commanded by the GOC Northern Ireland through the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland or possibly direct to the CGS. The troops I prepared for training were trained on the instructions of the Commander-in-Chief British Army of the Rhine, to whom they had to go. I had a certain responsibility, of course, for preparing people for out-of-area operations.
The strategic reserve.
And my influence, such as it was really working out what I thought the British Army needed and what it lacked, and going to the CGS and saying, this is what I think ought to be done, and also sitting on the executive committee of the Army Board, where I could make my views known. So I was a pressure group, really, an inspector general, a chap who could sit back and look at the whole scene rather than get bogged down with Whitehall matters as the CGS was. And I learned a great deal about the Territorial Army, which I, of course, had no experience of before. And I enjoyed the job very much. I travelled around a great deal, went to Ireland several times, I made some of my views on training, I think, felt. And I thought, I knew by that time, because having come Major General, Lieutenant General, Full General, one after the other, I knew that I was obviously in the running for CGS. I didn't know definitely whether I was going to get it, but I knew the running. And I imagined that if I was in the running, I would stay as Commander-in-Chief 2-3 years and then go on up. And it was a very, quite an attractive prospect. But, of course, when it was decided that I was going to be the next CGS, the Secretary of State, one Fred Mulley, said, the trouble with the army is that they've had these father figures, General Peter Hunt, and Field Marshal General Sir Rowland Gibbs, very respected father figures, chaps who greatly looked up to by the ordinary soldier, but don't really know their way around Whitehall at all. And the Navy and the Air Force always get in these chaps who've been man and boy in the machinery, the Ministry of Defence, and the Army gets short shrift because they don't have someone who knows the ropes. Well, I had, of course, the advantage of being with my baton for 2 years, but I was only there for 2 years, and I was a lieutenant colonel. And then I'd been with Field Marshal Montgomery earlier on, but that was when I was a captain. All the other times I'd had command jobs, and I'd been never near the Ministry of Defence. So although I'd had this compressed knowledge in my baton's time, my knowledge was a bit out of date. So much against the Army's wishes, because it threw the whole arms plot out, General Gibbs was ordered to take me out of being Commander-in-Chief, UKLF, and make me the Vice Chief of the Defence Staff, Personnel and Logistics, to get the up-to-date feel of Whitehall before going into CGS. And I think, actually, it was a very sensible move by the Secretary of State. The Army didn't want to do it because it threw their whole top plot sideways. But it meant I only did a bare 2 years as Commander-in-Chief. But, of course, it meant I came back right into the swing and started my association with the Chiefs of Staff Committee, because I sat on the Chiefs of Staff Committee, from 1978, which went right on, of course, to the end of 1985. So I had a very long period.
So this is a sort of very senior apprenticeship.
Absolutely.
Now, you said that you had some influence on training when you were at UKLF. What sort of influence was that?
Well, I think trying to get some of the realities that I'd worked out when I was commander of the 1st Division in Germany about what would happen in Germany. And also more mundane things like some of the infantry tactics, which I find unintelligible, really. I mean, as I say, take one very simple case. If you ever went to see a company of infantry dug in a defensive position, they were always sitting on the top of a hill or on the forward slope. And you'd say, well, why are you here? And they'd say, because the fields of fire are so marvellous. Fields of fire are extending up to 2 or 3 miles. So I said, but